So you want to know something funny? I could have swore for the longest time that nobody paid attention to the intro music I used on this show. And then I switched to using the same song all the time because I'm like, I'm only amusing myself with the intro music. And since I've switched to the Everclear song that I've chosen, everybody's made comments about it. It is the strangest thing.
Everclear, that's a name I've not heard since I was in college. Well, where'd those guys go?
Maybe that's it, because like I've been using Local God as the theme song, and I guess everybody's getting Romeo and Juliet flashbacks, and I guess people were noticing the theme music, or at least they're noticing that it's the same one. I don't know. Well, welcome to wherever you are. My name is Ryan McNeil in Toronto, Canada, and you are listening to episode 89 of the Matinee Cast. It's the movie-loving podcast of my movie-loving website, thematinee.ca, your home for cinematic passion and perspective. Today's guest is an old friend. He has been a supporter and a colleague of the site almost since its very beginnings, back when it was a blog spot site that looks a whole lot worse than what I have now. In that time, his site has gone on to good things. My site, lesser good things, but still, we're both very proud of what we do. And the one thing that we were talking about before this show began is that your site may very well go on to great things, but don't you dare expect any money in it, because neither one of us are seeing a dime. He is coming to us deep in the heart of Texas. He is Grand Poobah of Go See Talk, a site you can find at goseetalk.com. We're going across the wire to Dallas. Mark Ciafardini's back in the show. How are you, sir?
I'm doing awesome, Ryan. How's things in matinee land?
I don't know if you're having this problem in Dallas. There are too many movies out there for me to see.
Too many movies to see?
Yeah.
That's not really a problem in Dallas.
Okay.
It's just it's an across the world phenomenon. It's really, you know, three movies a week is criminally excessive, if you ask me.
I know. And the thing is, I'm not even making a dent. Like, I could go out right now. I could spend all weekend seeing two or three shows a night, and then maybe I'd catch up. But it's an embarrassment of riches at the cinema right now. On episode 89, we'll be discussing Pacific Rim. We'll be finding out people's call for the best film so far of 2013, and we will flip the record over to play the other side. Before that, though, we need to learn more about Mark. This is Know Your Enemy. So Mark first appeared on episode 20, where we learned that the first film he saw was Peter Pan. The last film he'd seen at the time was The Wrath of Khan, the worst film he'd ever seen. He pulled double duty and called out Paul Blart Mall Cop and the Miley Cyrus opus The Last Song. Thank you for those visions, buddy. The unseen classic or essential was Vertigo, which he has since seen, and the film that he wished he'd made...
Rocky?
Let's go with that. Mark reappeared on episode 41. The film he liked that nobody else did was G.I. Joe Rise of Cobra. Did you see the sequel?
I did, and I was highly disappointed.
Oh, no. The film that everybody else liked that he did not was Scarface. The last film to make him cry was Apollo 13, and in the movie of his life, he was played by Luke Wilson. So it's time for round three. Mark, sir, what was the film, and you can interpret this question in any way you want, what was the film that made your love for movies turn a corner?
I'd probably have to say The Usual Suspects.
When
I was a kid, I saw that. I think I was in maybe sixth grade, and I mean, talk about an ending that lives on and just endears. I mean, you know, I think a lot of people today, you know, use the term mind-blowing ad nauseum, but that really at the time was just, who saw that coming? And that really just made me think, okay, I grew up with Back to the Future. I grew up with Top Gun, you know, stuff like that. But none of those movies really floored you at the end like Bryan Singer's masterpiece. And that just, I think that's what made me think that film could be something other than what it is at the time I had been exposed to it.
So that was the first film to really, like, took almost, not on an adult level, because if you're like 12, you're certainly not an adult, but on a more mature level, that was the first film to really make an impression.
Yeah, I mean, there were some things that were over my head, things that I obviously was not going to gravitate or comprehend, but even at a young age, I could recognize this movie was cool, this had depth, this had a lot of gravity to it. And again, when you see Kevin Spacey turn his foot out, I want to say unfurl his hand at the end. That's
sure.
Just and in unison with the editing, it just, you know, wow. I mean, now I'm speechless. I can't even, you know.
Yeah. It's funny because I'm, you know, I'm a little bit older than you, but that's around the same time that I was seeing a different class of film. I'll always remember that one was – I hadn't even heard of it. It was one that my friends who were also movie nerds but bigger movie nerds than me, they said, come on, we're going to see this movie. And I was just like, yeah, okay, sure. I was just going along for the ride and a fun Saturday night out. Kind of like you. My mind was blown. I had no idea where the heck that was going. I thought, yeah, we're just seeing some random cop and robber story. And I was like – I think that was the thing for me. And this will actually dovetail into a question I'm going to ask later. Is it was one of the first times that somebody said to me, hey, let's go see this. And I hadn't even heard of it. And I went along for the ride and it was just awesome.
Awesome. That's really cool.
Fantastic.
And you know, one of the cool things about that movie is I think, and I'm not sure if it was the movie or just the time in which I saw it, but it was, you know, you use the expression in the question, what made your love of film turn a corner? I think it hit me at that time before I knew what was maybe overdone and before I was, you know, it wasn't that I was too young to understand it, and it wasn't that I was too old to get into other things. It just really – I think it was at the right point in my film – not career, my film filmophilia, and really just helped me turn a corner. So
good times.
Tripping over myself.
Yeah, no, good times. What was your first date movie?
Gosh, this takes me back a ways. It was The New Guy with DJ Qualls.
Oh,
do you remember that?
Man. Yes, I do.
Yeah, I was for me, it was sort of a significant point in my life. I was dating somebody in just the start of college, and it was it's funny. I mean, I was in Oklahoma. We didn't have a theater in our town. We had to kind of drive to the city, and it was like, hey, let's go see this movie. And
was that all that was playing, or? Like, sorry, let me rephrase. Was it deliberately chosen, or it was, hey, the date is going to be a movie. Hey, what's nearby?
Well, no, I wouldn't say what's nearby, because we had to drive literally an hour and maybe 10 minutes from Stillwater to Oklahoma City. So this was strategized, if you know. But
wow.
What it did is it gave me more time in the car with my, you know, at that point, girlfriend.
Right.
And the movie, you know, it's odd, it's stupid, it's funny. There's like a I love guilty pleasures, and to me it's sort of one of those, you know, it's a dumb Saturday morning movie. There's really nothing more to it, but there's some humor, wit, and heart in it that I kind of like. And even though that relationship has fizzled out, that movie still kind of, you know, resonates with me as
Well, it's kind of a tone setter, right? Because it's showing that you're not taking yourself too seriously. You know, if you go on like the first date and it's a drama or it's something gritty, like heck, even if it was Usual Suspect, you might not necessarily be starting off on the right foot.
True. It's sort of, I wouldn't say it's even a litmus test. It's really just it's a vanilla. It's some sort of bland, you know, entertainment that
yeah.
you have on a date. So
yeah.
That's yeah.
And of course, the funny thing is that as my friend Kurt likes to say, you know, the standard date is dinner and a movie, which is ass backwards, because, you know, if the movie's any good, you want to have time to talk about it. But you had both like the en route and the return to do all the talking in the car. Right, like the movie was almost incidental.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, it was. I wouldn't say it was popcorn because it wasn't that successful.
Right.
But it was a diversion. You
right.
know, it was an excuse to go out and do something. You know, something societally. I'm not even sure that's the right.
No, I like it. Well, actually, you know, something else that you're just pointing out to me, because this is where, you know, your growing up and my growing up are very different. I've never had to drive. I was almost going to say I've never had to drive to the theater, but that's a lie. I was going to say I've never had to drive an hour to the closest theater, but that's a commitment and a half, because that's really a 4-hour date.
Yeah, and you know, may God shine upon you if it's crappy from
the
get-go.
That's my point. Yeah, I was going to say, like, you know, if the date's going south and you're just at a restaurant, you can yeah. fake the phone call and get out. If you're already an hour away from home.
Mm-hmm.
And,
it's like, yeah.
Yeah. Oh boy. Well, I'm glad to hear that at least it went well by the sounds of it, and that it takes you back to fond times, because otherwise that would have been a terrible 4 hours. Mark, what's your sick day movie?
Encino Man. Up until a point, it was Dogma, but I realized I like that movie too much to, you know, fall asleep sick to it, or, you know, run to the restroom and, you know, throw up my guts when I'm sick. But Encino Man, and that's another one. I think that's why the new guy made me think of the Encino Man. I mean, I just have a penchant for not shitty movies, but just, you know, I have a weird sense of humor. I'll laugh at something even if the movie's a complete piece of crap. But, yeah, some movies just tickle me enough the right way that, you know, they, like G.I. Joe, it is crap, but it's enjoyable crap. So.
I was going to say, like, you're really showing your colors of, you know, a person of a varied, varied tastes here. I cannot recall the last time I watched Encino Man. I know I've seen it since it played originally. Like, when was the last time you threw it on?
I think it was back in either May or even might have been last month. Okay. I remember, yeah, I did an impromptu 80s marathon after a friend's wedding. You know, it's just, everyone's wasted at the wedding. You come home, it's like, what are you going to do? Let's stay up all night and watch 80s movies.
Right.
80s/90s. Yeah, so I've seen it recently, yeah.
So then I guess my question is, how does it hold up?
Thanks to nostalgia, it holds up pretty okay.
Okay. See, now the thing is, the next time you throw it on for a bunch of people, you need to ask one of the newbies in the room what they think of it, because they'll give you an honest answer.
Well, yeah, there's some like Pauly Shore. I mean, what has he been in recently? I just don't think that he doesn't age well. And he's an acquired taste. If you didn't like him in any of those old movies,
yep.
I've never seen Biodome. I've never seen Son-in-Law. Nope. But if you don't like him in Encino Man, you're not going to like him whether you grew up with it or not. So.
Wasn't there a montage to Right Said Fred, or am I thinking of a different movie? Like, doesn't I'm Too Sexy come up?
Yeah.
That's a sign you're in a particular brand of movie from, like, you know, one particular year of history. What was the last film to leave you speechless?
I really would have to say Life of Pi left me speechless, just because I think this might actually tailor more into your first question, what made my love of film turn a corner, because okay. I'd never seen anything like it. And I think that I'd probably equate it to, I mean, it was such a paradigm shift in the way the film was shot, you know, how the story came across narratively. And I think I'd equate it to maybe the way, or hopefully the way people first saw The Wizard of Oz, you know, something go from color, from black and white to color, and just sort of blow your mind with what film can do. And I think that it left me speechless in that sense, that I really hope that more films in the future push the boundaries and, you know, use visual effects and, you know, broken narrative and more artsy kind of films. And I don't know if this makes any sense. But
it does. It does. I think, like, the thing I liked about it is this is something I've heard from a few people this week, and I was kind of actually sort of talking about just before we went on air, is that it shows what can happen when a master filmmaker uses visual effects to their advantage, because I think the visual effects a lot of times are just a crutch. You know, they get a script that's just good enough, and they ramp it up with something that's really cool, you know, whether it's 3D or whether it's, you know, who knows what kind of effect it is, or, you know, like going back 10 or 15 years, like something like Bullet Time. But when you give these kinds of toys to a director like Scorsese or Spielberg or Ang Lee or Werner Herzog, they come back with something that's just, like you say, it leaves you just awestruck by what they can do.
Yeah, actually, I'm glad you came up with that CG and visual effects as a crutch, because that is used too much these days. And you're right, it's a way of supporting the story, a means of storytelling.
Yeah.
It's not just, you know, fizzle pop, wow. So.
Yeah, I unfortunately haven't revisited Life of Pi since the theater. I still haven't got my hands on the Blu-ray, but I really, really look forward to seeing it again. I was kind of surprised that people grabbed onto that movie. I thought it might not really land. Like, I thought it might be too earnest or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really, really happy to see it get so well received and like, you know, awarded and everything as well.
Yeah, I mean, even something as far as, you know, something that people weren't expecting, like the score from Michael Dana. Who would have thought that? And yeah, there's just it. I think I might have said this in my review. It's the kind of film we don't see often enough, but we need to see more of.
You got it.
yeah, something that takes chances. It's brilliant.
Last but not least, sir, what is a quote that would serve as your epitaph?
I would love to put this on it. Here we go. Air quotes. We really shook the pillars of heaven, didn't we, Wang?
Is that from Big Trouble in Little China?
Yeah, that's at the very end. Yeah, that's one of my absolute all-time top-to-bottom favorites. And I think one of the things that made me think of that that answer to your question was I had John Carpenter write the very same thing on my Blu-ray copy of Big Trouble in Little China.
Wow. Yeah, then you gotta. And you know what? Like, I do know I know people who, like you, are just nuts about that movie, and that would kind of be a test. Like, if somebody got that it was from Big Trouble in Little China, like me, then they're your kind of people. You know, they're the kind of person who would, like, see that and smile and nod, right?
I would hope so. You know, whether they're stealing my flowers or knocking over the tombstone, they'll at least get a chuckle before they carry on with their vandalism.
Nice. Well, that's more about Mark. I've said this a few times, but when I inevitably get him back for a fourth show, I'll have to come up with some whole new questions, but that's an awful lot about him for now. Moving forward, I do beg people's patience because my notes for this section have been compromised, and then this is the section where I need the notes the most. It'll be your chance to come talk to me right after this.
Why are you shaking like a leaf? Talk to me. Oh, please talk to me.
On episode 88, given that we're about halfway through the year, I asked people what their favorite film of the year was so far, or the best film of the year so far, of 2013 so far. And Mark, do you have any guesses as to what the most popular answer was?
If it's in the artsy community, I think it might be something like Mud or Spring Breakers.
Good guesses. They both got mentioned, but no. The most popular answer was Stoker by Park Chan-wook.
Wow.
Yeah, I thought so too. And there are a lot of answers, so we'll get back to that in just a moment. I do beg people's patience because they're kind of all over the place. Nick from Cinema Romantico in Chicago, he wrote in and told me that his favorite film of the year so far was Mud. Sean Kelly, SK on Movies here in Toronto, said Stoker. Not only did I like the film's somewhat dark, gothic subject matter, but I couldn't help but look in awe at the film's cinematography and editing. I could very easily pause the film at any point just to admire the film's carefully constructed mise-en-scène. We were just talking off air. That's another film that I, from this year even, that I've been meaning to buy the Blu-ray, and I just haven't got my mitts on it yet. And you know what? It's only been out for like 2 weeks, but it feels like it's overdue for me to buy it.
Well, I missed out on it, but what was that? Was that April? Was that March, maybe?
It was March, and it got a teeny tiny release. Like, I'm really looking forward to people finding out about this movie as the year goes on. Andy Hart from Fandango Groovers in England said that Before Midnight is his favorite film of the year so far. That was another popular answer. Dan Heaton in St. Louis said he hasn't really seen nearly enough movies this year. He's got a new baby, so that, of course, is understood. So my favorite is hardly a ringing endorsement still. I have to go with the obvious one and pick Before Midnight. It should definitely be in the conversation when I'm thinking of the best of 2013 at the end of the year. Did you see Before Midnight yet?
I haven't seen any of the befores, so makes me wonder. Okay. Yeah, I'm wondering.
I would suggest watch them all in like one weekend. Rent the two or Netflix the two, and then go out and see the third.
Okay, so you do have to see it in continuity.
Actually, you don't. They okay. All stand on their own. They're situations between two adults. People of any age will understand it. You don't really have to build upon it. It's nice, and you could I was almost going to watch them backwards, but they you get a little bit more texture if you watch them in order.
Okay.
On Facebook, Paolo here in Toronto said either No with Gael Garcia Bernal or Upstream Color, the latter actually feeling more personal and relatable. Christian Griffin in Chicago said Star Trek Into Darkness. A new commenter named Nick Turk, I believe he's in Australia, said Wreck-It Ralph. Sorry, he's in England. Said Wreck-It Ralph, which they just got this year. He calls that an absolute gem of a film. It wasn't my favorite, but I can see where he comes from with that. Joanna Klebis in New York City said, I don't know if it counts, given that it was at TIFF last year, but Much Ado About Nothing by Joss Whedon is easily one of the best films and Shakespeare comedy adaptations I've seen in ages. She also loved Frances Ha. Did you catch Much Ado About Nothing?
Neither that or Frances Ha.
Wow, you're dying down there. No kidding. It's really not a riches environment in Dallas these days, is it?
Well, let me just say, the movies are there, but
you can't go.
Yeah, it's either my interest, my schedule, or my schedule. Yeah. Or wait, my schedule. Yeah.
There we go. Well, yes, and by the way, Joanna, that totally counts. Sue Maynard from the Mind Reels said, I enjoyed Monsters University and Warm Bodies, but I think The Doc, Blackfish, is the best movie I've seen this year. Alex Kittle in Boston is another fan of Stoker. She said, followed closely by Upstream Color, Frances Ha, and something called Gimme the Loot. I do not know what. Do you know what Gimme the Loot is?
Yeah, actually, Andrew Crump, he does work for us. He also does work for ScreenRant.com. He really thought very highly of Gimme the Loot, and he got to interview the director. His name is, drawing a blank right now, but he thought it was very awesome.
Look it up on Go See Talk, folks. Greg Ashman here in Toronto said, that's easy. Before midnight, it felt like a gift bag being able to catch up with Jesse and Celine. We were almost 20 years into the relationship and this on-screen couple, with the results being breathtaking and heartbreaking. Sebastian Gutierrez from the Supermassive Black Hole said, it's a tie between Much Ado About Nothing and Stoker. Corey Pierce here in Toronto said, before midnight, no, Stoker and Frances Ha. And Corey and I actually saw a film called Museum Hours this week, and I think he'd probably put that in the running as well. Rachel Thoreau, who is now in Wisconsin, formerly in Arkansas, said, I haven't seen much, seriously, maybe 6 films so far this year. Moving to a new state and having a baby will do that to a person. But I still love The Great Gatsby and Much Ado About Nothing. Jemima Bucknell, who is from Australia, said Spring Breakers. And Matt Kowalski of the Across the Universe podcast, I believe she's in Germany, said Spring Breakers, its ambiguous realism and emotional storytelling confuzzled me. That's a great word, in the best way possible. Did you see Spring Breakers, dude?
No, I didn't. Again, another one of the ones, the casualties of scheduling.
Yeah, that one just dropped on Blu-ray, so I'd actually kind of be curious what you thought of it. It's one of these very, very divisive movies. Like, people either dig it or they really hate it, and I get the feeling that it caught a lot of people off guard.
So. Well, again, that's another one that Andrew, he saw early. I think he saw it at the Boston Independent Film Festival, or I forget how he saw it, but he loved it, and that was in his top 10 of the year on plug here. Go See Talk.
I should have got him to guest on the show for all the talking we're doing about Andrew Crump.
Well, I mean, I'm sorry. He wrote an awesome review of Pacific Rim, so maybe we should just cut this short right now, and you can go catch him before he heads to the bar.
Good night, everybody. On Twitter, Will Malone said, The Great Gatsby, Baz's over-the-top style meshes perfectly with Carraway's inflated memory of Gatsby. Infatuation abounds. Jessica from the Velvet Cafe in Sweden said, The Danish film, The Hunt. Most definitely. Can't recommend it enough. Brian J. Rowan down in D.C. is a rare and precious snowflake because he has a 3-way tie for the top film of the year. He is calling Spring Breakers, Upstream Color, and To the Wonder the top films of the year. Brian, I've seen To the Wonder. You are crazy. Bubba Wheat from Flights, Tights, and Movie Nights and the Film Wise podcast said, I haven't seen too many, but I would have to say Man of Steel. That's a controversial choice, I believe. I dug it, but I know a lot of people did not.
I don't want to get into Man of Steel right now. I think just one of the things it was missing was a fun factor.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I can see that. And you're right, that's probably a whole other show. Christopher Bell in Brooklyn said, a film called Old Dog.
Have you heard of that? Did Andrew Crump cover that too?
No, he didn't.
So I guess, Christopher, thanks for the recommendation. I'll look up Old Dog. Adam Moody said The Place Beyond the Pines. There's your call there. And Spring Breakers with Upstream Color and To the Wonder right behind. Oh, there we go. I shouldn't have made so much fun of Brian. Josh Johnson in Brooklyn said The Act of Killing or Upstream Color. He can't decide. Dor Dotson, also in Brooklyn. Brooklyn is representing here tonight. Also said The Act of Killing, which is opening here in Toronto next week. So I'm finally going to see this movie that a lot of people have been talking about. I know it's a documentary and it looks kind of loopy, but that's all I really know about it. Anna the Movie Nut said it's a tie between Mud, Francis Ha, and Before Midnight. James Blake Ewing, down in your fine state of Texas, who just had a birthday yesterday, said Like Someone in Love by Amos Kiarostami. Shala Thomas in Georgia said Fruitvale Station, which opens here next week, and I'm looking forward to that. Johan Ander said, Johan is in Sweden. Two films are tied, Star Trek Into Darkness and The Hunt. Well, technically The Hunt is a 2012 film. That's his thoughts, not mine. Where did you come down on Into Darkness?
This kind of goes along with the Man of Steel. It's sort of, I think this would be a whole nother podcast. It's, you know, people are wondering, you know, where's the original storytelling in Hollywood? And you have two films within a month of each other that are pretty much redos, remakes, reboots of seminal movies. You know, you've got Man of Steel is pretty much a redo of Superman 2, and Into Darkness is a reboot of Wrath of Khan. So
in every way possible, like that really surprised me. That when I later then came home and watched Wrath of Khan.
Yeah, I mean, right down to the
we'll leave it there. Yeah, Rich Watson in New York City said he can't decide between Mud, Stories We Tell, and something called The Mother of George. He loved them all. Amir Sultani here in Toronto said Museum Hours. There's that film again. But on a different day, I might say A Hijacking, Before Midnight, or Blood Brother. Will from Silver Emulsion said, I haven't seen too many yet, but it's definitely not Oz the Great and Powerful. Thank you, Will. That's a different way to answer the question. Andrew Robinson, the G-Man in Trinidad, said Man of Steel because laser eyes rule all. Come on, guys. Superman kicked all sorts of ass, and that's what we need this summer. See, you know, like, again, I tell you, people love it.
I just thought that one of the things that kind of –
you wanted more fun.
Yeah, well, and you have to look at it this way. This is a segue into what may or may not be the Justice League, and it's the pace set by Christopher Nolan. So, you know, you're not going to have a sort of fun and carefree Superman. You're going to have something that's following the lead of the Dark Knight. Yeah. So it was more serious than it probably needed to be.
Yeah.
I'm not even going to go into the length of the movie, but it was something that – it could have benefited from a couple more, you know, pick-me-ups.
Yeah. Jess Rogers in upstate New York said her favorite has been Stories We Tell. Alex Thomas in Australia said he was unashamed to say The Great Gatsby. And last but not least, Pat Mullen, I believe he's here in Toronto, although that feels strange because I've never met him. And if he's here in Toronto, I should have met him by now. He also said Francis Ha. Okay, there's a whole lot of titles. We got a whole lot of Francis Ha. We got a whole lot of Stories We Tell. We got a bunch of Spring Breakers and To the Wonders. Now, you said Place Beyond the Pines, and what was the other one?
The East.
The East. Okay, so Place Beyond the Pines is an interesting story because that's kind of an epic. That's not actually one that I really expected to do all that well. What did you dig about that?
I think it comes down to the way it was told. It was not just an epic. It wasn't just a family, you know, in crisis movie. I loved how it was broken into three distinct acts that right. were not done broken into flashbacks. It was pretty much chronologically, and you can throw acting, you can throw star power out the window. There's just something about the way the story was presented that I think it really gravitated, at least with me. And then when you throw the star power on top of it, and you throw what Ryan Gosling can do with, you know, minimally acting, you do, you know, Bradley Cooper coming up, the momentum he had from Silver Linings Playbook, and then the young kids, Dale DeHaan and I forget the other young actor, you know, the way they all came together, the way the movie was presented, and I mean, had this been done in any other way, I think it would have just been sort of forgettable. But it really came across like this powerhouse of an emotional drama, and I couldn't get enough of it, really.
That film, now that I think back on it, first of all, that movie is deep, deep, deep in my memory, because I saw that at the Toronto International Film Festival last year. So I'm something to the effect of 10 months removed from the last time I saw that movie. But the one thing I will always, always, always remember is it might have one of the very, very best opening shots of any movie. Do you remember that opening shot?
Yeah, it was the motorcycle in the roller cage.
Well, it's not only that, but it's the long follow shot of Ryan Gosling in the trailer and then walking through the carnival, getting on the bike. And at one point, there's what the director refers to as a Texas switch.
Which yeah.
The next time I watch the film, I'm going to look for it because I didn't see it the first time. But there's a Texas switch because if you're not looking, it appears as though Ryan is the one who's on the bike inside this like globe of doom where the motorcycles are riding around the edges and defying gravity. For me, well, I'm going to touch on one briefly. Mostly because you haven't seen it and mostly because I talked it to death last episode. But Before Midnight is right now one of my very favorites of the year, for all sorts of reasons that I mentioned back in episode 88, and also just for being a mature film and being able to show difficult conversations and adult problems and what love and life is like in 2013. Another one I was really, really taken with this year is one that Jess mentioned, Stories We Tell, which is a documentary by Sarah Polley. It actually debuted in Canada last year, but it's getting its world release this year, and they're actually kind of positioning it for a potential Oscar run. So I count it as a 2013 film. And it's a really simple story. It's basically just – it's Polly telling the story of her lineage, because there becomes a question of whether or not her father is actually her father. So she talks to her family about it. And on paper, it seems like, you know, the most facile idea for a documentary. Like, one family tells their story. It's, you know, is there a great crime in this family? No. Is there a great struggle in this family? No. It's just – you know, there's all kinds of families like it all over the world. But the way she tells it and the way she pulls focus on to storytelling in general and how important people are within the scope of a story is fascinating. And it's a really, really great movie that I hope more people get a chance to see. I know it's kind of making the rounds in the States now, and then it's going to hit DVD and all that jazz in September. But it's a really great doc, not just a great documentary, but it's just a great film, period, that has really, really impressed me this year. For next episode, it's going to springboard off an experience that I just had where I just went and saw a film that I hadn't even really heard word one about, but I went on somebody's recommendation. So going back to something we mentioned earlier, I want to know, what is a film you watched, either in theaters or at home or on your phone or however you watch it, what is a film you watched that you knew nothing about but you just went on somebody's say-so? And I'm especially looking for films, obviously, that you liked, because if I told you to watch a film and you watch it just because I told you to watch it and you hated it, I don't care. I don't want to hear about that. But what was a film that you dug, that you really, really enjoyed, that somebody just said, watch this, and you took them at your word? Tell me who, tell me what the movie. ryan@thematinee.ca, Facebook, where it is facebook.com/darkmatinee, or Twitter, where I'm matinee_ca. We are going to talk about Guillermo del Toro's new film Pacific Rim coming up right after this. Pacific Rim is directed by Guillermo del Toro. It was written by del Toro along with Travis Beecham. It stars Charlie Hunnam, Idris Elba, Ringo Kikuchi, Charlie Day, Ron Perlman, and a host of others. Pacific Rim can basically be described as giant robots versus giant alien monsters. It takes place in the future. We find out that monster aliens are entering the Earth through a chasm in the Pacific Ocean, and they are called kaiju. Humanity gets together, they build these giant-ass robots called Jaegers, and madness ensues. Mark, I'm going to start on a base level. What did you think of this giant summertime cheeseburger that we call Pacific Rim?
Wow, cheeseburger.
A very good cheeseburger, but we'll get back there.
I wasn't overly thrilled, but I had a lot of fun.
Okay. Now, it's kind of funny because your first message to me upon seeing it is that you had issues. So you had fun. That's one thing. But what did you think? Like, were you just going with your emotion, or was your brain kind of fighting you on it?
I think there were two parts of me. You know, the 6 to 12 year old part of my body is going, yeah, sweet, rock 'em, sock 'em robots, and you know, all kinds of, you know, immature stuff. But the other part of me is going, this is Del Toro. I love the set design. I love, you know, I love what he's able to create and how he composes scenes. But there's just a part of me that went, wow, the first 20 minutes are awesome. You know, you have this fantastic score by Raman Djawadi, who did the score to Iron Man. And I really sort of didn't like the whole middle. I think that it was just a little too long.
Interesting.
Yeah, to get to the good stuff. But you know, that said, the good stuff is totally worth it.
This is not reinventing the wheel. This is not anything like The Matrix or Inception or any of those movies that seem to transcend the genre. Like, this is not going to leave you thinking about any larger ideas. I think we can both agree on that.
Yeah, and that's a good point, because, you know, Del Toro makes genre films.
Right.
I mean, and that kind of – that's it in a nutshell. This is a genre film.
Exactly. So. And the thing is, while it will not really give you a whole lot of what Del Toro himself has called eye protein, as opposed to eye candy, he's called something called eye protein. There is no eye protein in Pacific Rim. But you know what? That's okay, because – what it's trying to do, what it has set itself out to do, I really think it achieves on every level. It's you in some ways you have seen this movie before. If you've seen Independence Day, if you've seen the original King Kong, if you've seen any Godzilla movie, you have seen this film before, but it adds to that canon so very well.
Yeah, precisely in the way that you could say that about any action movie. You'd be like, oh, I've seen a machine gun before. I've seen two Desert Eagles before. You know, it's like, yeah, you're right. He's not treading new ground. There's nothing mind-blowing or genre-busting. It is a fulfilling entry into these types of films. And I think I was thinking about – been really trying to figure out how to phrase this. It's like a roller coaster. You know, you go there to have fun. You don't go there to overly criticize turn three and say that the pitch on the entry was too steep. It's like, no, don't break this down into specifics or you know, deconstruct it. Did you have fun and did you leave smiling? I think that's the only thing you need to ask yourself.
Yeah. Now, getting back to my intro, the reason why I use the cheeseburger as the analogy, this, I don't know if this is just a Toronto phenomenon or if this happens all over the world, but Toronto is undergoing this like weird burger restaurant boon. Like every week, it seems like there's another one. You'll go to the place, and if you feel like a cheeseburger, you can just very easily go to Burger King, or you can go to any little greasy spoon and you get yourself a cheeseburger. But if you go to a place that does one well and uses some really good meat and uses some nice cheese and they got all kinds of great toppings, it's a really, really good cheeseburger. It usually costs a little bit more, tastes a little bit better on the way going down. It's still terrible for you, and it's not going to leave you with any kind of nutrition, but it's really, really good. And that's that for me is Pacific Rim. It's not at all something that is looking to do anything exactly new. But that's not the worst thing in the world. I think a lot of what we're getting hung up on when people like you and I come to Pacific Rim is we're getting caught up with the name Del Toro, and we're wanting more Pan's Labyrinth, and we're wanting more Kronos, and we're wanting more Devil's Backbone. We don't really want him wasting his time on something this, you know, let's be honest, something that seems this trite.
Okay, good point.
Okay, so, but that, I don't think that that's the worst thing. I think that in this summer, when we've seen a lot of pre-packaged franchises that are based on something already, and you know, we go into these movies and we've seen them before, this plays very differently. It plays like something that's got a little bit more imagination, a little bit more heart, and something that we haven't just seen 2 years ago.
More to that point, I think what you can say is that Del Toro, for all the way he's able to create, you know, impressive worlds and really become a strong filmmaker and artist, this is him just playing with toys and doing a really good job at it, as opposed to Michael Bay smashing things together that are incoherent and stupid.
Yeah, he kind of reminds me of, you know how there's always one kid in the class who's sitting there playing with Lego, but he's making something really good out of the Lego, whereas the kid sitting next to them, the colors don't match. And that's what I kind of think, you know, you'd look at the Lego that Del Toro makes and it would look really good.
I agree 100%. Yeah.
Now the cast in this movie is, they're all pretty well cast, I think. Like, there was nobody who stuck out to me as doing any kind of a bad job. Was there anybody who gave you any kind of problems?
That's actually something I haven't thought about in a while. I haven't had a problem with acting in like maybe the past 6-8 months. I think that whether the movie falters or succeeds, you really can't fault the actors for not pulling their weight.
No.
And I think that this is a movie that, you know, it's got to be the material. They can either bring it to the next level or transcend it, but I have no problem with the acting.
I don't watch Sons of Anarchy, so Charlie Hunnam was a new experience for me. He's okay. Like, he does the job and just kind of stays out of the way. He doesn't really have any kind of memorable quality to him. Like, I wasn't thinking to myself, yeah, I want to see the sequel so that I can see more Raleigh, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody else, especially the character I was latching on to the most as the movie was going along, was, and it could just be because I love the actor, was Idris Elba as Stacker. I really, really liked the way he was running this whole show. No, really?
I have no problem with Idris.
If you do, this show's over.
No. I mean, Luther is one of my favorite shows in ever. Idris is great. He was the right part for this, but in this movie, you want to see more of him. And I don't think that it, you know.
He's in like every scene.
Well, it was more the Charlie and Rinko show, but go on.
Okay. Well, the thing that I like about him is that, of course, in a movie like this, somebody's got to get up in front of a crowd and give that St. Crispian's Day speech, you know, and he does it. It's the moment you've seen it in the ads for the movie where he says, "Tonight we're canceling the apocalypse." And I find that speech you either nail or you miss way wide. And I've seen films where somebody tries to rally the troops and it's like, you know, if I was one of the troops, I would just be completely uninspired. So hearing him do that and hearing him try to keep his hand on the tiller while all this happens, I really, really thought that they cast him well and that he makes the most of what he's given.
Well, I think that's what I was trying to get at. Okay. You know, you're right. When he comes onto the scene, you pay attention, whether you know him or not, and he sells it.
Don't get me wrong. There are a lot of moments where there are like I'm specifically thinking of the rivalry, for instance, between the Australian Jaeger pilots and pretty much just Raleigh on his own. We've like that goes back to Top Gun, right? If not, probably earlier than that.
Yeah, it's funny. There was somebody on the Ghosty Talk Facebook page who said something about how it was like a ripoff or a redo of Top Gun. I hadn't really thought about that while I was watching it, but the rivalry you mentioned really kind of – it doesn't irk me, but that's another one of my problems with the film.
Oh, man. I don't know. And then like on top of everything, the one thing that we haven't really talked about yet is on a base level, anytime we're watching these fights where you've got these giant creatures waist deep in the ocean, and I don't mean they're waist deep as in they're just, you know, a few meters offshore. They're well out in the ocean, but it's only coming up to their midriff. It's fun as all hell just watching them clobber the hell out of each other.
Totally, and that's the draw of the movie. It goes back to what you were saying. It's robots versus aliens, cut, print. Let's see that for, you know, 150 minutes.
Right. We're just a few weeks removed from everybody and their brother complaining about how seeing people clobber each other into oblivion in Man of Steel was a slog. Meanwhile, you get it here, and it's very much the same thing.
and it's an absolute joy.
Well, this is my thoughts on it. You have Superman, you have Zod, you have people who are technically immortal. You have monsters that can bleed, and then you have robots who can be destroyed or dismantled. So it's sort of with Man of Steel, and again, it's a whole nother topic. There's no stakes in the game because you know Superman's going to win, but you're watching a movie like this, and win, lose, or draw, it's just awesome to see things that are fallible, you know, are brittle and can be broken, go at it, and no matter who wins, it's going to be exciting to watch. Right. So
okay. So now, was that most of your problems with it, or was there anything else that really, really didn't work for you about this movie?
It took a little too long to get to the good stuff. However, that being said, I think that Del Toro is smart enough that he didn't, and I think this is one of the most brilliant parts of the movie, he didn't make it a video game. He didn't make it something like, hey, this is your first monster, kid, rookie, sport.
Yeah.
Why don't you try your luck on this and see how you do? And it's a progression. This movie is almost like you have to fall and learn and, you know, recoup yourself before you can go and succeed. And so it's not just like, hey, the plot's going to set up the next monster. It's not the first season of Voltron. You know, there's some weight and gravity to it. You know, do you know what I'm saying?
I do know what you're saying. I'm pleased as punch right now because in 89 episodes, nobody else has channeled Voltron. But thank you for that. You know, the one thing I do like about this movie that it feels like this is one of the things where I talk about attention to craft and certainly attention to storytelling is key in this movie is we get a, I'm going to say 5-minute intro that talks about how Kaiju came to Earth and how humanity rallied together and they built the Jaegers and there was a fight and they thought that was over and they built a memorial and they moved on. But it turns out that was just the beginning. It takes 5 minutes to set this up, right? To just give you all the information that you need to know and then, all right, go. My theory is that a lesser movie or something that was coming prepackaged, like a lot of the other films we've seen this year, would turn that 5 minutes into a whole film. They would make that movie with an eye on 2 or 3 or however many sequels they wanted to get out of this Pacific Rim franchise, and they'd say, we're going to tell an origin story and see where it goes. And the fact that Del Toro and his co-writer had the cojones to just keep that as the intro, I think really, really speaks volumes about the type of story they wanted to tell and how they wanted to tell it.
That's a very good point. It kind of goes back to what I think I might be paraphrasing here, but I think it was Shakespeare. He said, brevity is the soul of wit.
Right.
You can just do so much more, get people on board. And, you know, this kind of goes back to what you're saying. We've seen this story before, so there's no need to make a whole story about some guy who, you know, who experiences what he experiences in the intro. You know, do that 90, 120 minutes. Do that succinctly and then get on with your story. So I'm right there with you.
Yeah, well, and the way you put it that way, it's almost a double intro because they give the greater story, you know, the aliens come and we build robots and away we go and this happened and this happened. And then they give a specific story when they talk about Raleigh and his brother. So you, again, which may, all of that may very well have been expanded out into one film in lesser hands. And that's where I really feel, again, that's on a surface level, anybody could have told this story. You could have got any director for hire and given them this script and this budget and said, go, and they probably could have given you a very similar effect. But I feel like Del Toro is a really, really good storyteller that he's able to keep on point and not just keep the line moving, because he does, but also realize what an audience wants versus what a lesser director wants to shove down their throats.
And he's also strong enough to say that, you know, I am who I am. You see my track record. I know that this works. And so he can sort of get away with that too, you know?
Yeah. Let's talk about the look of this film for a second. What did you make of the actual smackdowns between these? Like, we're drifting further and further into worlds where everything is CG, which is fine. But like, mm-hmm. were you buying it? Were you ever taken out of the film? Was there ever moments where you thought you were watching a video game, or were you really, really immersed in the look and the effects of this film?
No, not one bit was I taken out. And actually, that's a really good question you brought up, because for me, and I think that CG aside, whether it was practical or CG, I think that the scale of this movie is its most impressive feature. I mean, the size of the Jaegers, the depth of the Shatter Dome. I mean, everything, all the sets. I mean, I think everything was perfect, you know, and that brings me to my next point. There was not a time in the movie that, and this is sort of like an across the board paradigm change. Effects are just getting so good these days that you do not know where a set ends and CG begins. Even, even things that you think are practical effects are CG most of these days. And there was like very few times, I mean, aside from the Jaegers, fighting the kaiju that you knew was CG, it didn't look like a CG mess, I mean, things are just so fine-tuned. Cars, debris, people, sets, smoke, and even in the intro, after what happens to Riley, when you see him in the Jaeger and see him about, exit,
yep,
you just don't know what's real anymore. And I think that is, the scale of the movie and the CG, I have no problem with. That's some of the best I've ever seen.
Yeah. I don't know about you. This movie's a little over 2 hours. Did you ever check your watch?
I did because of the whole middle.
Past that middle. Oh, man.
Yeah. I'm sorry. It just comes down to, for me, it's a double-edged sword. Like I said, it's half of me wanting to see more of the good stuff that I saw in the first 20 minutes, and then half of me respecting the fact that Del Toro didn't make this a chapter – a chapter-based movie. It's like, okay, after 15 minutes, we need to see another, Jaeger. We need to see another kaiju go at it. It's not a boxing match. I mean, it really is. It's an endurance race for the human race. And I think that's probably one of the smartest things about the movie. It shows you kind of how hopeless people were and how society bands together to fight this, the thing that could extinguish the human race. So, I mean, I'm still struggling with that. And, don't get me wrong. I still want to see this again. I still had a complete blast, but I'm still – part of me goes, I wanted to see Monsters sooner. And part of me is saying, hey, I'm so glad they held off to the end, because the finale is just it's awesome. It's mind-blowing.
It is. Well, we close out every review here on the Matinee Cast with the souvenir. If you were to, take your walk through the Pacific Rim store, and lordy, could I ever envision an actual Pacific Rim store? Somebody said, I can't remember where it was, so I do apologize, but somebody out there said, isn't it nice to have a movie spawn the toys and not the other way around?
That's true.
So I imagine somewhere out there you will be able to buy the Jaegers and the kaiju from this movie in short order, but I am happy that they don't already exist. So anyway, if you could get yourself a souvenir from Pacific Rim, but whether it's a shot or an actual piece or a line or anything like that, Mark, what would you want to keep from Pacific Rim as a souvenir?
If you can bottle that feeling from the very beginning of the movie, when the first track of Ramin Djawadi's soundtrack kicks in, it's almost like the music's in movement, some sort of mousing Gypsy. Was it Gypsy Danger?
Which is a strange name for a Jaeger, I must say.
If I could sort of, that's my takeaway, that whole intro. I mean, there are great intros with music in movie history, but this is one of the ones that I really, automatically takes you back to being a kid again. And that's my takeaway. If you could bottle that and sell it, I would buy it by the carton.
Nice. Well, for me, the one thing I would keep as a souvenir, we didn't really talk about it too much in the review, is the character, the pairing of Geisler and Gottlieb, that's Bern Gorman and Charlie Day, as the two scientists. I could have watched them for hours.
Actually, I'm so glad you brought that up. I think that's part of the brilliance of the movie, that Del Toro, in different from things looking cool and having a sort of explanation, he gave this whole science side of it. And it's a nice duality between the rock jocks and, you know, the fighting for the human race, but then you have this great despair. I can't believe I didn't bring them up once, but I totally understand where you're coming from. I agree 100%.
Yeah, the thing that's awesome about them, first of all, it's a great idea for a pairing, because you've got Gorman as the guy who's the very, very physics-based dude. He's doing all the math and talking about how this is all happening. And then you've got Day as the biologist who's trying to find out he's like, I don't care how it's happening. I care that it's happened, and I'm trying to find out what made it happen in terms of the actual, natural effect of what goes on inside a kaiju. And they play, they're such opposites. They play so well off each other. Charlie, every once in a while, he speaks for us. Like, Gorman really, really starts getting very, very mathematical and throwing out some lofty theories, and Day is just in the background going, "Can you believe this guy?" And he's basically speaking out loud our inner monologue in the audience. And I would watch infinite amounts of films with the two of them together, because they work, the actors work so well together, and the characters are written so well. I love them.
That is a great takeaway. Yeah. Excellent. I'm going to give you a golf clap for that.
Nice. Thank you. I appreciate that. Well, we rate our movies on the Matinee Cast on a score of 1 to 4 stars. So, Mark Giafardini, what do you give Guillermo del Toro's Pacific Rim?
I'm going to go with a solid 3.
A solid 3. You hurt me deeply, because you know what, sir? This, for me, is a 4. I had so much fun with this movie. I really expected to be... Pardon the pun. I expected to be monstrously let down by this movie, but I just had such a blast, and it works despite itself. So for that, I got to give it props. This is a 4-star movie. If you don't have fun with this movie, I pity you, really. And I know people who didn't have fun, so I do pity them. But that's our take, 3 and a 4. Maybe we're completely crazy. Maybe one of us is crazy. Let us know. Ryan@thematinee.ca, Twitter, where I'm matinee_CA, or Facebook, facebook.com/darkmatinee. What do you think of Guillermo del Toro's Pacific Rim? We will be right back after this with The Other Side, where we'll talk about 2 more movies that go well with Pacific Rim, so come on back. So for Mark's choice for a flip side to Pacific Rim, he decided to match up the robots. He went back to 2011 and chose a film directed by Sean Levy. You went with Real Steel, which is the movie about boxing robots. Now, to be fair, we will get back to it, but to be fair, you chose that blind. You chose that before you saw Pacific Rim. But why, when your brain went to robots, did it automatically think Real Steel?
Because in Pacific Rim, you have robots that are manipulated and commanded by people. You know, they're not autonomous. Okay. And so I thought that would be perfect, because in Real Steel, these robot boxers are really just pantomiming and following the commands of a robot programmer. So, you know, it seemed to me to make sense. And obviously you have Cold Steel and sort of a warm heart, and, you know, it's interesting to see the way a filmmaker can take something that is, you know, static and try to give it a heart and soul, and without picking something like maybe The Iron Giant, which I love. I just thought that would be too easy. I thought that this would be a good pairing.
We also talked about Iron Giant 2 episodes ago, which you would know if you listen to this podcast, by the way.
I'm sorry. I'm going to fall back on scheduling. Sorry.
It's always nice to meet a fan. The cool thing about Real Steel, and the one thing that I noticed in relation to Pacific Rim, is we were saying earlier that visual effects have come so very far. Like, in both cases, in the case of Pacific Rim and in the case of Real Steel, they feel very genuine. Like, especially in Real Steel, like, it feels like Adam is actually on set a lot of the time. And maybe you can tell me, I don't know how much was actually done with props versus what was done with digital, but he really, really felt like he had weight and interaction with Hugh Jackman and with the kid Dakota Goyo.
And the reason for that is because they did have a, I wouldn't say tremendous, but a lot of props. They had practical effects. They actually went the old school route. And they had a lot of, you know, on-screen chemistry because there was something there, not a tennis ball, not a green screen that's three stories high. And and that's one of the things that made that, to me, very endearing, is that you're actually you're able to read the human element playing off something that's there. But also, exactly like you said, I mean, if you watch that first fight scene in Real Steel, or even the part where Ambush comes out of the trailer,
yeah,
I mean, that just blow. I mean, kids these days can spot CG a mile away, but that is, you know, perplexing because you just don't know that that's real. I mean, or that you know, that they've just come such a long way and they make it look so, you know, so real, even if it's fake, and vice versa. So that is probably one of the most impressive pieces of the movie, is just the tangibility of the robots and what's going on screen.
Yeah. Now, I got to tell a story. When I went to get this movie, first of all, I was actually kind of laughing to myself because you actually chose a movie that was a little bit hard to source. My local cable provider did not have this on demand. Netflix Canada was of no use at all. So I had to go old school and go rent it from a bricks and mortar DVD shop that's up the road.
Uh-huh.
And I felt so dirty about renting Real Steel. That do you remember when you were younger and if you had to buy like a box of condoms, you'd throw in like a magazine and a bag of chips?
Yeah.
Yeah, to take the onus off whatever. That was what I had to do. I had to rent like two other artsy fartsy movies to take the onus off Real Steel because I felt so dumb renting this movie.
Well, it's not a white box with a black label. It clearly shows Hugh Jackman and a kid on it. I mean, come on.
Here's the thing. So, you know, I use the analogy back during Pacific Rim that it was a really, really good cheeseburger. Real Steel shows just how hard it can be to make a real good cheeseburger, because as cool as I thought those robots were and as cool as those fight scenes are, anything that was happening in between was not working for me. You know, when you suggested this movie, were you suggesting it despite the father-son story and certainly despite the boy-girl romance that they try and kind of pepper in? Or were you suggesting it with all that in mind?
I think for me, I was all in, and okay. I wasn't trying to give you, you know, I wasn't trying to throw you a curveball, to use some vernacular you might appreciate. I wasn't trying to just, you know, blindside you or something. I really enjoyed the movie. You know, the robots are the draw, but for me, I like the Rocky aspect to it. Yes, it's a blatant, complete ripoff and redo of Rocky with more, you know, with more kid-friendly banter and with more romance thrown in. But there, even if you don't buy that, and you know, you bite into the robots, the robots is still impressive and fun. So that's my whole direction for trying to compare and pair this movie with the on-screen barrage of robot violence with Pacific Rim. So, you know, if you at least bought into that, then I think I did my job.
Okay, and that's that was the point, was, as I said, like when those fights were happening, I was very, very deeply drawn in. Certainly like, I guess spoilers for Real Steel. Certainly in the final round, like the final round of this movie, I was all over. I thought it was great when you had to basically get Hugh Jackman to shadow box four Adam. I thought that, like, that was kind of what I wanted more of. I didn't really need a whole lot of the precocious kid. I certainly didn't really need the custody struggle. But anytime they were doing the boxing, I almost would have wanted to go for a movie that was just about that.
Well, in a way, you know, it's funny. My gripe with Pacific Rim, or my half gripe with Pacific Rim, was the fact that it wasn't, it took too long. It wasn't set up like a video game. Real Steel is completely, and aside from mashing all of the Rockies in one movie.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean all the Rockies.
Yeah, exactly. It's like there's, you know,
there's a Bridget Nielsen,
Clever Lang, there's Drago.
Yeah. Yeah.
It just, like, that is a Rocky cornucopia, but it's also, you know, it was also a video game. And then again, that's why I pride Del Toro for making a movie like Pacific Rim that had more human element. I mean, you have that really crappy, you know, this is one of my gripes going back a bit. the whole world is band together to build Jaegers to fight the kaiju.
Yeah.
And what do you have? You have some cocky Australian pilot who is the one, you know, hurdle, stranglehold, you know, keeping Raleigh from his duty. It's like, really, guys, did you have to throw in that, you know, and you mentioned the Top Gun rivalry. It's like, guys, everyone else is on the same plane here. Can we not just get along for 20, 30 minutes? You know,
it's as a robot film, and certainly as this kind of a robot film, like we could say things for robots, like androids, like David in Prometheus or another David AI and all the androids that happened in that movie. But for this kind of steel and gears and automatronic robots, this is kind of a really, really good example, even if for me it shows how hard it is to do this kind of movie. Because I got to be honest, part of me almost wants to see what a guy like Guillermo del Toro could do with a story like Real Steel.
Yeah. And what he would do is he would slow it down and he would make it like he would slow it down.
All right. Fair enough. Well, this was your recommendation. So kind of like a souvenir, but just kind of like the pairing, what would be your takeaway for Real Steel? Like, what do you think is the ultimate marry-up that should drive a person from the lobby coming out of Pacific Rim straight to their copy of Real Steel? What makes the perfect marriage of these two movies?
Well, I think you hit on it before. It was the ending. And, you know, as weird it is to say that you should get behind and feel the soul in a movie about, you know, static or plastic robots, not plastic, metal robots. But if you're not on your feet at the end of the movie, you either have had a terrible childhood or you just are not watching the right movie. Because, I mean, as goofy and cheesy burgerish as it is, it's still enough to get you roused, you know, to bring it to your feet. So that's my souvenir.
I'll give you that. And that is a good marriage because, you know, that's been the selling line for Pacific Rim is that it talks to our inner 12-year-old, you know, who doesn't know better about, you know, problems like boring middles. And that was actually my thought as well was, as I was watching it, I was thinking to myself, you know, 12-year-old me that loved Top Gun and loved Days of Thunder, he would have really dug this movie. Mm-hmm. So I kind of wept for his long lost disappearance.
Just going back just a bit, you know, you talked about a movie that someone could suggest to you and you know nothing going in, or even how you thought Pacific Rim was not going to be as great as you thought it was. I thought Real Steel would be a nosedive. And I think that's another reason that I found it so good. It's like when something's not a complete and utter nightmarish train wreck and it's actually somewhat good, you cheer for it. So that's you know, it hit me on two fronts. Yeah. An emotional front and, hey, I'm glad this wasn't a pile of crap.
There is one other film that I think would make a really, really good pairing with Pacific Rim, and it's my choice for another side. You can find out what it is right after this. Well, for my choice of the other side, I went with a film that can kind of be seen as something of an origin story for a film like Pacific Rim. I went back 3 years to 2010, and I chose the Gareth Edwards film Monsters, which is, if you haven't seen it, is about kind of the aftermath of a world where aliens have come to live among us, and it's a road story of two people who are trying to get from the middle of Mexico back into America. Now, I take it that before I suggested Monsters that you had already seen this movie.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. Now, what do you think of it before we get too far into things?
It's one of those great movies that focuses on people and a small scale and lets your imagination do the rest.
Right. Right.
You know, it's a whole less is more philosophy, and in this one it paid off brilliantly.
Yeah, and that is actually what I really, really like about it is, let's face facts, we're living in a time where people go, if they even go to a big screen, they want to be wowed. Like, I can think of very few people in the general public who are going to drop down their hard-earned money and go sit in a theater to watch a movie like Monsters. They want to see giant robots fighting giant aliens. They don't want to see something that's this subtle. But the one thing I like about it is that it is this subtle in that
it's not, it's called Monsters, and yet there's very few monsters in it. It's more about the people that are trying to make their way through this monster inhabited world. So we meet Andrew and Samantha, and they're played by Scoot McNairy, who you might have caught in like half a dozen movies last year. He was in a bunch of stuff, including Argo and Killing Them Softly. The girl he meets is Samantha. She's played by Whitney Able, who really hasn't caught on in much of anything. And it's kind of on the road with an alien threat is what it is, or it happened one night with an alien threat, because they really don't know each other. They've just got to get through this Mexican terrain. And we don't spend too much time with the monsters so much as we see the effects they're having on the world. It's kind of the complete flip side to Pacific Rim, which is why I think it might work as a really, really great companion piece, because Pacific Rim, you know, it certainly lays low a lot of cities around the world, and we do see, of course, some of the after effects, but Monsters has these people literally walking through them. So we're seeing whole craters that have been dug because a plane is down, or the effects of this alien invasion on even just the foliage and like the trees and the plants in the area. And I think it's what kind of story you can tell when you focus on the minutiae of this world.
Precisely, yeah. It's kind of like if you were to take this is one of my favorite scenes in the movie, is where in Pacific Rim, Gypsy Danger is fighting one of the last kaijus and chasing him down the streets of Hong Kong. But lo and behold, he steps over a footbridge, lest not trample on a couple passerbys. And it's like you have all this big screen action or off the screen action or, you know, action that's passed. And yeah, the people who are in the bomb shelters, people who are trying to just make their way and recover themselves. It's like, yeah, there's a nice, it's a nice, what do you call it, symbiosis, yeah, to the story.
Yeah. Now, when you first saw Monsters, like, were you caught off guard with like kind of with its course of how it's really about the people and not so much about the aliens?
Yeah, especially after the intro, you know, because the whole thing's a, I don't know if this is a spoiler or not, because it's just the narrative structure, but it's a flashback, you know?
Yep.
And so it does take you back, because yes, if the title says Monsters and you're watching a movie and 20 minutes in, you're going, wait, what's all this foliage, you know?
Where are the monsters?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. But that's part of the brilliance of it, you know? It's not a mumblecore movie, it's not an asylum movie, it's not even a low budget movie. It's just it's a human scaled movie that happens to have a couple tentacles in it. So,
Yeah. Well, funny thing, it is actually reasonably low budget. They made it for $500,000, which sounds like a lot of money to people like you and I. In the scope of movie making, that's peanuts, especially when you consider that a movie like Pacific Rim cost closer to $200 million. So this was director Gareth Edwards. This was his foray into feature films. He started making this movie and started shopping it around, and it became a hit for him off $500,000. He ended up making $4 million off this movie, and it was fantastic. Like, it really, really resonated for audiences, not just who went there to see Monsters, although I do imagine that a couple of people were duped, but you know, for people who just heard really, really good things about this couple, about Scoot McNairy and Whitney Abel, and how they played off each other and how they worked their way through the Mexican landscape and dealt with this story.
Well, I think it's funny you mentioned I think you have to kind of look at what who did District 9? Was that
Neil Blomkamp?
Yeah, Neil Blomkamp. I mean, that was a decently budgeted film, but it still felt small because it focused on, you know, the after effects, the small sort of, you know, I don't want to say it was a Jim Jarmusch movie that focuses on the drama between the drama, but I mean, it definitely brought it down to something that was tangible. I mean, you look at something with aliens and independent. Sure, it had, you know, a human element, but it was laughable. It was cheesy. The real draw was the monsters, the aliens and their firepower. This just scaled it down to what people could, whether they were duped by the title, they had something they could relate to. And I think that, I mean, that's the draw of most movies, you know, in our film history. It's something that you can gravitate towards. And
yeah. A friend of mine likes to say that some of the very best sci-fi movies are really not about the effects there, but they're about how the science affects the people within the story.
Ooh, I like that. That's nice.
Yeah, yeah. I'm paraphrasing him, but I might even be paraphrasing him badly. The one kind of last thought I'll leave you with before we move on from monsters is the director Gareth Edwards. As I said, this was his first really big feature, and I kind of see it as something of a run-up to something like Pacific Rim, because I don't know if you know this or not. You probably do, because you run the very highly acclaimed Go See Talk that employs Andrew Crum. but Gareth Edwards' next project that he's going to be dropping on us next year is a remake of Godzilla. He turned this little calling card small sci-fi movie, much like Guillermo del Toro did with things like Kronos and the Devil's Backbone, into something where a studio gave him a huge amount of money and said, go make something gigantic. Go take your big imagination and put it towards something huge. And that's the thing it's the kind of story I like to hear coming out of Hollywood. I like to hear these directors with small beginnings get their shot at something big. And even earlier on, like you mentioned Neil Blomkamp and a movie that he's making that we're going to see in just a few weeks is Elysium, where he's working with Oscar-winning actors and getting a gigantic budget and making something that's going to get a huge push. And I love that we're seeing these small genre and sci-fi directors make these really, really big stories, because I feel like they bring better things to the game, no offense to this movie that you enjoy, than Sean Levy did in Real Steel.
Fair enough. I agree. But part of me says that, okay, with Elysium, that's more up, you know, more up Neil Blomkamp's alley. I'm just a little worried that not only will Godzilla, especially after Pacific Rim, be redundant, but I'm just not sure if you can have somebody who – I mean, this is not knocking his talents, but I just don't know what he's going to do with Godzilla. I mean
– I don't know either. Like, all I know is, we're going to see Japan and we're going to see a great big lizard. That's all I know.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So in that aspect of the, you know, somebody who's talented getting his shot, I'm with you 110%. I can't wait to see that. But part of me just goes, hey, I need to know more about – the prospect sounds good, but let's see what the pitch is.
Here's the flip side is we don't know what he's going to do with Godzilla, but really, how much worse can it be than what Roland Emmerich did with Godzilla?
True.
Exactly. Yeah. See, I win.
Yeah. I don't get me wrong. I am not going to defend Godzilla, the 2000 or 1999 Godzilla.
1998, because you are a smart, smart man. Well, since I just won, we're going to close it there, because I barely ever get to win. That's episode 89 of the Matinee Cast. Come on back on Monday, July 29th for episode 90. We'll be talking about Only God Forgives, the new film from Nicholas Winding Refn. Mark's site can be found at goseetalk.com. Do you have anything coming up this week that people can look forward to?
Personally, I'm going to see The World's End, and about a week later, I'm going to get to interview Sean Pegg, Nick Frost, and the one and only Edgar Wright. So look for that review and interview in the coming weeks. But
very cool. And since we've talked about him already, what's Andrew Crump working on for your site?
He's at screenrant.com. He's got a gig doing some news stories, and
what's he doing for your site?
I'm sorry. He's writing news stories, trailers, quite a few great reads, editorials. Nothing recent, but just check his back stuff. He does amazing work. So,
and where can people find you on Twitter?
I'm at GoSeeTalk.
Very nice. My site is thematinee.ca. For more audio content, you can find back episodes by going to thematinee.ca/podcasting. You can also find them using apps like Blueberry, Listen, Apple's podcast app, and Stitcher Radio. You can also find them in the iTunes Store. If you do go to the iTunes Store, do me a favor, leave me a review. It'll help me raise the profile of the show. Canadians especially, I've gotten a lot of great, wonderful words from my American listeners, but I kind of need a little bit more of a boost in the Canadian store. Everything, you get ways to subscribe. and get alerts when new episodes drop. Feedback on Pacific Rim, Monsters, or Real Steel, and movies that you watched because of somebody's recommendation can be sent to ryan@thematinee.ca, Twitter, where I'm matinee_ca, or Facebook, facebook.com/darkmatinee. Mark, do you have any final thoughts before we sign off for the night?
Yeah, I think that if you're going to leave comments on Ryan's website, you might as well leave something on our website that agree or disagree that Clifton Collins Jr. is the best Latino Doctor Who the world has ever seen.
They do need a new doctor, so I think they could do far worse than Clifton Collins Jr. For Mark, I'm Ryan. We'll see you at the matinee. You'll find me in the matinee.